Just how dangerous were those 737 fatigue cracks? What's the safest row of seats in an airliner? I'm Paul Platt, and this is Aero News. Welcome in to the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. In yesterday's special feature, I started a discussion on aircraft safety with George Bible, who's a professor of mechanical engineering at the School of Engineering and Mines, University of North Dakota, and is the author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. You'll hear the rest of our conversation today. George, I recently read an article which claimed to be debunking a myth that some rows of seats in an airliner present a greater likelihood of surviving a crash than seating in other rows. In your research for the book, were you left with that opinion, or is this really a myth?
Well, what I came up with is post-crash fire is a big deal. On the cover of my book, there's an Airbus landed in Toronto in 2005. The top half's totally burned off. You got to remember the entire inside's filled with plastics, but all 301 passengers got off safely in spite of half the doors being blocked, which incidentally is a FAA requirement of a new plane design. They got to test it with live passengers and verify they can evacuate it in under 90 seconds with half the doors randomly blocked. But anyhow, what I came up with, first thing is sit close to an emergency door or in the emergency row to get off the plane ahead of any potential fire. And the other thing I was struck by, there's these structural joints as they assemble the sections behind the cockpit, in front of, behind the wing box, and between the back of the fuselage and the tail. And when the plane slams into the ground, that's the places where it's most likely to break. And I talk about examples where planes hit so violently they break into three pieces, and still, surprisingly, two-thirds of the people sit or survive. But anyhow, when the plane breaks, you got a half a chance or a good chance of disrupting the floor connections between the seats and the floor beams. And at that point, you kind of, the passenger can become a flying missile, sort of like being a passenger in a car accident without a seatbelt fastened. So that's a severe danger. However, having said all that, recently Popular Science looked at 19 crashes since 1971 in the United States, and they concluded in 11 of those 19, people were safer in the back, and 5 people were safer in the front, and 3 it was a toss-up.
All right, so that sounds to me like the data set is so small that it's hard to draw any meaningful conclusions.
Well, that's what they came up with. So that's a survey of 19 crashes, and you can say it's too small. They do put the black boxes in the back of the plane. I guess there is some tendency for a plane to crash nose down.
Okay, and I also remember reading accounts of one crash detailed in your book where the tail cone detached or broke away from the rest of the aircraft, and all the people in that portion of the plane that broke away were, well, not uninjured, but they all survived when many in other parts of the plane did not.
Yes, except right at the break, if you lose your seat connection. They talk about the survivability requirements. You got to maintain the tie-down chain. Normally the seat belts don't break, but your seat could break off, especially if the fuselage breaks all around you. Mm-hmm. You got to maintain a survivable volume. In other words, you're not crushed to death. And you got to have survivable impact forces. I did quite a bit with the history of the crash dummy and G crash testing. I think the Germans determined during World War II, on average, 25 Gs would crush your spine. And you got to survive the post-crash environment, which is usually a fire issue. So those people survived in the back of the plane, but I think some of them right where the fuselage broke had problems.
Now, in your book, you offer a number of experiments done with balloons, and I found that very interesting, and I'm going to try some of them. in order to be able to better visualize how a monocoque construction aircraft break when they encounter an impact. And fatigue comes up, and you talk about fatigue cracks and how they grow to a certain point very slowly and then become unstable where they spread rapidly. And you talked about that especially in the section about explosive decompression. Do the recent stories of missed fuselage fatigue inspections are they a cause for legitimate concern for airline passengers? Is this something we should really be concerned about?
Well, I don't know. I think they're nitpicking over details. On the other hand, they got to draw the line someplace. What I came up with, it's pretty standard design that a fuselage is supposed to be safe against pressure with a 40-inch fatigue crack, which is quite remarkable. I think that you could fly around a 40-inch fatigue crack. In fact, I even found a case where they had a 39-inch fatigue crack in a DC-9, I think, in 1995. And they didn't even have problems pressurizing the cabin, amazingly enough. They found it during an inspection. So anyhow, the recent ones in the news with Southwest, I believe those cracks were like 2 to 4 inches long. Now, they'd never allow you to fly with a 10, 20, 30-inch fatigue crack. It's supposed to be structurally safe, according to the computer analysis, with a 40-inch fatigue crack. But they'll phase in various things depending on the length and depth of the crack. They may require, they may allow a patch. They may require it to be flown to a service center where they can cut out the fatigue. They may fly it with no passengers, or they may require it to be repaired within a week, or they may even fly it with no pressure, depending on how big the fatigue crack. So I don't think a 2 or 3 or 4 inch fatigue crack is that dangerous. That doesn't mean FAA is inappropriate for harassing them. I kind of liken it to speeding in a school zone. If you found out they were speeding in your kid's school, in front of his school all the time, nobody's doing anything, I think I'd be upset too. But does that mean you should take your kid out of school, run home, and hide under the bed? I don't think so. No, it's that sort of thing. It's just like a speed limit. You have to have a speed limit. If it's 20 miles an hour in a school zone, are you an evil person if you're going 21 or 22? Probably not, but you still have to have enforceable rules.
My guest is George Bible, who's the author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. We'll be back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Do you feel stimulated? Hey, that's why Congress passed the Economic Stimulus Act of 2008, so loyal Americans like yourself would feel stimulated to help rev up the economy by spending money on important stuff like new Garmin avionics. We're talking potential tax incentives, bonus depreciation up to 50% in first-year cost allowances for qualified business use equipment purchases. See your tax advisor for guidance and your Garmin dealer for one whale of a stimulus package. It's almost like your patriotic duty, huh? Garmin, follow the leader.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and no ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft is the next generation of headset design for a number of reasons. Clarity Aloft headsets are known for the superior clarity of sound. They're lightweight but rugged enough to meet military specifications. Best of all, they boast better noise reduction than ANR in the speech frequencies that matter most to you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headset on the web at clarityaloft.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Plack, talking today with George Bible, author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. George, let's talk for a moment about the relationship among the various players in these investigations.
The NTSB is in charge of investigating things. They tell the FAA what they think should be done. The FAA may or may not do it based on its burden on the industry. Sometimes there's outrage and Congress will step in and get involved in at some level. Does this system generally work? Do the FAA and the NTSB normally work past the political influences to get the right answer? Or should we find some better way to do this?
Well, I studied airplane crash reports for 3 or 4 years from a technical point of view. And I, at least from my point of view, I was happy with what I found. And you got to realize the way the system works. The NTSB is in total charge of the investigation unless the FBI moves in. And they have subpoena power and they can swoop down and seize your records and compel you to testify, but they never have to do that. Everyone cooperates. They realize how pointless it'd be or how bad it would look if they didn't. So they do their thing and it's, they let the cards lay wherever they may. They typically take 1 or 2 years to do an investigation, sometimes 3 or 4 years for a more complicated one. And their whole point is to make safety recommendations, to determine probable cause and make safety recommendations. And incidentally, probable cause isn't a legal standard. You can't even introduce the NTSB report in the any lawsuits in the court, even though it represents the best evidence available, but it sneaks in anyhow. Both sides hire their expert witnesses to testify. But anyhow, the NTSB only cares about safety recommendations and probable cause, and they may make recommendations a lot sooner in a few weeks or a month or two if they think there's a safety improvement to be made. And where it gets a little dicey is they actually have no authority to enforce any of their recommendations, and that's entirely up to the FAA. And in fact, the FAA participates in all the investigations. Sometimes they're the focus of the investigation. The NTSB might conclude the FAA didn't have sufficient oversight, and the FAA runs the air traffic controller system. They might conclude it was an air traffic controller and therefore an FAA error. So the NTSB controls the investigation and makes recommendations, and the FAA decides what to do with them. And the rule of thumb is they accept 80% of them. And some of them go on for years and years. One of the most recent ones is inerting fuel tanks after TWA Flight 800 blew up over the Atlantic in 1996. So when they delay or resist the recommendation, it's always due to cost, and people get upset about that, but you got to realize every time you get in a car, you're doing a cost-benefit analysis. We kill, on average, roughly 40,000 people a year. It was as high as 50,000 people in the 70s and 80s. So we're talking something about 2 million people in the last 50 years, which is absolutely unthinkable. But everyone grew up and understands that risk, and nobody gives it a second thought. And we could probably reduce that by 90%, but a car might cost $1 or $2 million. So that's an example of a cost-benefit analysis. We choose to accept the risk of killing literally millions of people because nobody wants to buy a $1 million car. So they got to draw the line someplace on cost, and it always becomes an issue, and I don't think it's an evil thing.
Well, I guess where people are willing to call it an evil thing is just try and start this conversation in healthcare.
I mean, well, sure.
You know, I mean, there's an issue about, you know, if technology makes it possible to save you from something and it's going to cost $10 million, people tend to assume that suddenly it's their right to be saved from that and somebody else needs to pay for it. But that's kind of getting off into another tangent. You said you're going to write a book about train wrecks next. Is that as interesting, more or less interesting?
Well, from my point of view, it's very interesting. I'm a little surprised to see the, with few exceptions, they're more or less flying off the tracks the same way they did 100 years ago. They still have brake failures and runaway trains, and bearings get so hot they burn off the axle, and things like that have been happening forever and still happen, albeit a lot less often, but they're still happening.
Well, I look forward to seeing not only seeing the book, but seeing what you choose for the cover art on that one, because, like I said, I had to remove the paper jacket that showed that Airbus on the ground before I felt comfortable pulling that book out of my carry-on to read during the airline flight. But, George, I really want to thank you for writing this book. I want to recommend it to our listeners as a very interesting thing to read if you are at all interested in the way airliners have been improved over time as a result of forensic investigations. And we wish you all success and continued good luck with your next book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
George Bible is a professor of mechanical engineering at the School of Engineering and Mines at the University of North Dakota. He's also the author of Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. It's published by Johns Hopkins University Press. You can find the book at Amazon.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.